At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but Mint's premium wireless is $15 a month. But I'd like to offer one other perk. We have no stores. That means no small talk.
Crazy weather we're having.
No, it's not. It's just weather. It is an introvert's dream. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown.
The Mirror of Great Britain. The life of James VI of Scotland and the First of England is a major reassessment of one of Britain's most important monarchs. James died 400 years ago, but was one of Britain's most consequential and interesting monarchs, not least in creating the British monarchy itself. I'm delighted to say that the author behind the book, The Mirror of Great Britain, Claire Jackson, joins me. Excuse me. Live on the line now. Good morning to you, Claire.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. Is it safe to say that the TV series notwithstanding, we've sort of brushed over James the First of England and Sixth of Scotland? I mean, the only thing that people tend to know about him is when he's mentioned in the Gunpowder Plot and maybe the Bible, of course.
Yeah, I think there's sort of two things going on. I think he has the misfortune of being sandwiched between Elizabeth I, Mary Queen of Scots and Scotland, and the fact that both of them were women is interesting in themselves. But also Charles I is his successor in 1625, responsible for the Gunpowder Plot. And I think, you know, James gets kind of missed between the attractions of them. But I also think the fact that he is Sixth of Scotland and First of England has its own problems. I think the Scots are interested in him only as long as he's King of Scotland, tend to lose interest around once the court goes to England in 1603. And the English still tend to sort of assume he comes from nowhere in 1603, whereas he's actually been King of Scotland for that point for nearly four decades, having been crowned at the very young age of 13 months.
Yeah, indeed, because, you know, he is the son of Mary Queen of Scots, and that brings in a whole, I mean, the fact, and what's his father's name? It begins with a D. It completely
Darnley.
Thank
Henry
you.
Stuart Lord Darnley.
Yeah, one of the most interesting characters in Scottish / English history, and I listened to a podcast the other day, said Darnley was the sort of person who would in the 21st century be wearing red trousers and going to Twickers and that sort of thing.
Yeah, very inconsequential. But the son that he and Mary, Queen of Scots, nevertheless produced is really remarkable.
And the fact that he actually gets to the age, because there's all sorts of shenanigans going on in Scotland at this time with his birth, and there's that whole sort of Catholic v Protestant or Church of England backdrop playing very. So the fact that he actually managed to get to become king when he could have quite easily been deposed, walled up in a castle or whatever else was a very high possibility. His early life must have been very dramatic.
One of the themes of the book is really just resilience and survival. I mean, he's the victim of assassination, kidnap, all sorts of plots, basically from the moment he's born. He's often in later life satirized for being sort of chary or scared of violence. But if you think about the numbers of times and the number of people who were out to get him to advance another candidate, it really is remarkable. The Gunpowder Plot is the one that sticks in the popular memory. And had it succeeded, the plot, it would have been, you know, an atrocity on a massive scale. But it was only one of a series of attempts on James's life. He was abducted by a group of Scots nobles when he was 15 and held under sort of house arrest for 10 months. And James was very serious about marking them. In a way, one of the reasons I wanted to write this book on the anniversary of his death was that anniversaries mattered to James. The Gowrie conspiracy, when he was held under house arrest for 10 months, even though he was king when he was 15, he marked that. He made it a sort of solemn celebration, not only in the Scottish church, Church, but also when he became King of England in the English Church, but also the gunpowder plot. We mark it 400 years later to the day. So anniversaries mattered to James because they were reminders of the times when he felt he'd been benefited from God's providence, keeping him safe.
And it's James I of England, James VI of Scotland. For those who need a sort of quick refresher in what Scotland was like before the Act of Union, because it's very, you know, popular knowledge seems to get as far as that bleeding Mel Gibson film and then drop off a cliff until we get the other film, Rob Roy, you know, and we have the Jacobite rebellions going on, which is obviously linked to this as well. It's the Stuarts versus the Tudors versus the, you know, William of Orange and the and then you have the Scottish Reformation as well, the rise of Protestantism and Catholicism as well. So, I mean, what's the situation in Scotland when, I mean, obviously we have, when James is born, his mother will very soon afterwards flee to England and then be held under house arrest until her eventual execution.
Yeah, Mary Queen of Scots is, you know, a fascinating, very, very large figure in Scottish history, but very problematic for James in a way, because he only becomes king because her actions outrage the Scottish Protestant nobility so much that they effectively depose her. They imprison her in Lochleven. They force her to sign letters of abdication, and they crown this toddler, this 13-month-old king, to be a Protestant king. Mary never accepts that is legitimate. She flees pretty disastrously, choosing England. I think had she fled to France, where she had once been a queen consort, because her first marriage had been to Francois II of France, things might have been different. But she ends up in England, throwing herself on her cousin Elizabeth I's mercy. Elizabeth is none too chuffed to have a Catholic queen, who many regard actually as the rightful queen of England, given that Elizabeth is regarded by Catholics as a bastard and a heretic. And there's a sort of 20-year standoff where Mary Queen of Scots is kept basically a prisoner of the English state. And one of the chapters in the book is that sort of triangulated relationship between Elizabeth I, who is James's godmother, and Mary and James. There's lots of interest, you know, in films, in operas, in literature between Elizabeth and Mary. But actually, once you factor in James, there's a lot of interesting power play. Elizabeth often says, you know, she is a much better mother to James because, you know, she's kept his country Protestant, she's kept his country peaceful. Mary tries all sorts of different strategies in her relations with James, but often usually all her letters are being read by the English state anyway. So really interesting sort of dynamics, as well as being totally traumatic for James in upbringing.
Two words there, or one word, Cecil, of course, who is absolutely intercepting all that, and that he is the Queen's, the Queen Elizabeth's eyes and ears. But looking at what Mary, I mean, Mary, Queen of Scots, did, you know, had a claim to the English, throne. And perhaps it is the fact that James becomes eventually king. I mean, it is Mary's endgame. I mean, Mary, Queen of Scots, when given the option to play, you could argue that she makes some absolutely disastrous decisions. She should have gone to France. She would have lived eventually. And she shouldn't have tried to reinvent herself as the Catholic monarch, because obviously, Elizabeth is a Protestant English monarch. So there's only one way this is going to plan out after the horrors of Bloody Mary, who has obviously been she's almost been airbrushed out of English history. But that's another subject.
Yeah, and one of the skills of James that I try to bring out in the book is how he handles his closeness to Catholics, because he is the son of Mary, Queen of Scots, and Catholics across Europe are outraged when she is executed on Elizabeth's orders, and they think that James's role is to sort of avenge this. Queen Anna, he marries a Danish princess who is a good Lutheran, but she covertly converts to Catholicism. He has a lot of Catholics around him, but he remains a very staunch Calvinist. But he does strengthen his claim to succeed Elizabeth through the 1590s by making it very clear to Catholic states across Europe that he's not a persecutory monarch. He manages to keep both Protestants and Catholics on side and assert he is the rightful heir to the throne. Elizabeth is really phenomenally negligent in making not only banning all discussion of who will succeed her, but actually making it a treasonous crime, a capital crime, which is, you know, for somebody in their who is now in their 60s to ban any discussion of what will happen when you die is not really a very sort of prudent way of governing your kingdom. And a lot of English are terrified that on Elizabeth's death, England's going to be plunged into some very bloody civil war. France might get involved. Spain might get involved.
Absolutely.
So actually, James has this very successful, patient, really quite strategic campaign to position himself as not only the rightful heir in hereditary terms, but he's Protestant, he's male, he's got three children at this stage, Prince Henry, Princess Elizabeth, and Prince Charles. And the succession, when it happens in 1603, is remarkably peaceful. One could argue that in a way that's the English crisis. And the minute James arrives, he comes to London, you know, for them, it's over. For James, he sees this as a massive opportunity. He's finally succeeded to the English throne. This is the time to create Great Britain. And he is then quite disappointed when the English really aren't that interested.
So what are the personal qualities? Because again, we tend to see him as a two-dimensional figure. I mean, again, recent TV series notwithstanding, which put some, should we put some flesh on the bones, put some colour on the man himself? But you mentioned it's patience. And in a world where, you know, we're just coming out the back of the, you know, the back end of the Tudors, if you pardon the expression, there is chaos going on over in Europe, which will basically end up with, you know, huge wars, you know, across the, you know, the German states. Spain is itching to get involved, as are the French, because that is their want. So to have a sort of sober, and I mean that in the sort of in the way that he deals, and a calm and collected monarch is it's got to be a plus for you know, England and Scotland.
Absolutely. I think one of the things, again, I try to bring in the book is, I mean, this is Britain's most learned monarch by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, he has a phenomenal education. George Buchanan, one of continental Europe's sort of foremost humanists, trains him up. One of the things I try and bring out as well is he just loves words. He's cited over 650 times in the Oxford English Dictionary for his particular usages of words. He publishes on just about every subject imaginable, political theory, poetry, theology. He is the kind of moving force behind the King James Bible. So he is massively interested in everything. And those skills do play out across the European stage. I mean, Elizabeth I had been noted for her isolationism. She didn't keep ambassadors in any Catholic country apart from France. One of the strengths of James as a King of Scotland is that although it's a relatively small country on the edge of Europe, he has always had a very big diplomatic presence. So he's sent ambassadors across Europe. He's also welcomed ambassadors to Edinburgh. And he carries on doing exactly the same when he comes to London. So suddenly England goes from being this slightly curious, quite small, oddly Protestant state on the edge of Europe to having a monarch who says, I want to be at the centre of every single diplomatic negotiation. I don't think war's the way to sort it out, but I actually understand the background to all of this geopolitics as well as the theology.
And the other thing is, in fact, you just mentioned what a word that's changed its meaning in the 21st century, but humanists. Now, humanists for us would mean, oh, somebody's got an interest in human beings. Humanist in the 17th century is somebody, a humanist is somebody who's looking back at the great works of Greece and Latin and the whole thing and using those and studying them intensely and applying those ancient texts to modern day life. And that is the cornerstone of what is, you know, the Italian Renaissance. The Medici are hugely into, Luciano Pellegrini is hugely into the humanist teaching as well. So he's looking not just south of the border, but he's looking to be part I was going to say single Europe then for a moment, but you see what I'm saying here.
Absolutely. I mean, he really is, and he loves having authors from continental Europe, especially Protestants who are finding it difficult in their Catholic states. He welcomes them to London. He envisages actually setting up what he calls, sort of known informally as Chelsea College. He really admires the way that the papacy have lots of people writing on its behalf. I mean, they've understood the need to get their message across in all sorts of different forms, because this is really the first era of mass print as well as newspapers. Mm. James has this idea of setting up a Protestant sort of college, bringing in really learned theologians who can write well, who don't need to be bothered by either, I don't know, a fellowship in Oxford or Cambridge or a country parish, but actually paying them to write Protestant propaganda. It's a brilliant idea. For various reasons, it doesn't take off and it gets abandoned during the civil wars. But, you know, he was just fascinated by print. I mean, he's a really published author himself in lots of different formats. And then he publishes all his collected works in 1617. 17 and then a Latin edition afterwards. So he wants to engage because he realizes, as we know today, that, you know, wars are often fought as much through print as they are sort of on the battlefield.
So he may be embracing what you could compare to the internet now today as, you know, modern print. He may be a humanist, but, and this is something that's going to come back and bite his son on the, I was going to say on the posterior, but it's going to take his head off, the divine right of kings. And that is, that perhaps shows the various sort of struggles of the man. I mean, can you be a humanist?
But I think it depends what you do with that divine right of kings. I don't think in itself it is that controversial at that time. I mean, if you look even at the time that Elizabeth II was crowned in 1950s, the mass observation data shows that actually a lot of people still believe very strongly in that power of anointing during the coronation ceremony, and that's in the mid-20th century. So back in 1603, the vast majority of people felt that kings were placed by God on earth to do their bidding. That's why you treat the offspring of kings, even if they're bastards or illegitimate, that's why you treat them as different, because they really do have, if it's not blue blood, there's something different. So there is something sacred. All of that isn't controversial. I think it's what you then do with it. I mean, in James, he's very big on the rhetoric of divine right of kings. He's very big on the fact that he is the one who's going to be answerable to God at the end of the day, and that there is nobody superior on earth to judge him. But he's perfectly capable of recognizing an impossible position with a parliament and negotiating. The problem is Charles, although he doesn't write as much about the divine right of kings as his father, is absolutely inflexible and authoritarian in how he then uses that belief.
And why have you called the book The Mirror of Great Britain? Is it that you think James is a cipher for what Britain is going through?
It's a good question. There's two reasons. One, it's a very famous portrait of James. If you look up the Mirror of Great Britain, it's a standing portrait of him just after he acceded to the English throne, where he's wearing a very prominent hat jewel. And that hat jewel is made up of jewels from the English and Scottish royal collections. And the hat jewel is known as the Mirror of Great Britain. But it's also one of James's favourite literary metaphors. So in the introduction, I talk about how he often uses himself as he describes himself as giving to his subjects a mirror, that if, you know, that this is a very rare, mirrors are actually quite new in Jacobean England at this stage. And he's really interested in sort of, I don't know what you might call it, vitreous technology, that crystal mirrors have just arrived. And, you know, it is possible to give somebody an accurate reflection. So he draws on a very old tradition, what's known as the mirror for princes literature, where you would hold up a mirror to a king and say, this is how you should behave. And what's different about James is him saying, well, I am the mirror and the king. And he uses that language. And one of the things about mirrors, of course, is that they can give accurate reflections, but they can also distort and deceive. And, you know, I play with that a lot, because James is actually a very skilled dissimulator as well. Partly is why he's such a good diplomat. He's very good at telling people what they want to hear and then telling somebody completely the opposite. But both sides believe that they're dealing in sort of very faithfully. So the introduction is a bit of a riff on mirrors generally at this time, because there is just so much fascination. If you think about that moment in Macbeth, which James is often thought to have been one of the first, sat there at the premiere, you know, where you know, they hold up a mirror, and if James was in the audience, he would have seen multiple reflections of him and his ancestors sort of stretching forward. So yeah, the introduction is a bit of a riff on mirrors generally.
And having said that, you know, before, he may be the person that the mark gets skipped out between Elizabeth and then the Civil War. We've had this TV series, he'd been front and centre, and of course his sexuality has been a huge talking point, and people say, I didn't know they got up to such revelry and ruffs, basically.
Yeah, and I think in a way, you know, that's what's made James's posthumous reputation a little bit two-dimensional, because people either know that he was really interested in witchcraft and sort of presided over witchcraft trials, or that he was gay, or that he was bisexual. I think some of the more recent research, you know, if you look at people like Shakespeare or other people at the time, I mean, you know, same-sex relations were just seem to have been far more common and not sort of treated with that kind of doctrinaire categorization that we reach for now, that, you know, somehow your sexuality is, you know, defined at the sort of core of your identity. One of the things I say in the introduction is that, you know, homophobia has been a really big influence shaping how we see James, but Scotophobia was far more virulent among his English contemporaries. I mean, they were not worried about really what he got up to with, you know, a whole load of handsome young men, as long as he did his duty dynastically, which he did, you know, with his wife producing seven children, not all of whom lived beyond infancy. But they were much more worried about him being a Scot, favouring his Scottish court. There's always suspicion about Scotland's old alliance with France. You know, that's what really worried contemporaries.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, Richard the Lionheart could share a bed with the Queen of, with the King of France for years, and but at least he wasn't a Scotsman, quote unquote. So it goes to show where that, is it all the Victorians? Do we get to say, you know, because they were looking from the moral high ground, and a lot of supposedly, and I do that in inverted commas, but the way that an awful lot of up to this point, but an awful lot of, say, mid-20th century history was viewed was through the prism of the Victorian historians who wrote tomes, and therefore, just because you've got 17 volumes of the life of so-and-so doesn't mean they're any good, but they have put their own viewpoint on it.
And they were very interested in the civil wars, the mid-century civil wars of the 1640s, because for them that was then part of a great Whig history of progress. That, you know, that's where Parliament asserted itself. That's where religious toleration came from. That's where, you know, sort of Britain's emergence as a global superpower came from. All of which is pretty teleological and pretty distorting in its own right. But somehow James, through Charles, became sort of bound up in the discrediting. To believe that narrative, you need to discredit what went before. So I think the Victorians were very down on James, partly because of the allegations of sort of, they would see it sort of gross indecency. And yeah. One of the remarkable things about James is just how open and free he is in his loves and his declarations for men as well as women.
So...
angle. But I think this discrediting of the Stuarts began much earlier through the 18th century. I mean, to believe that the Civil Wars meant anything, you had to sort of discredit what went before. So the whole kind of discrediting of the Jacobites after the so-called Glorious Revolution through the 18th century, all that kind of Whig history, none of which positioned James very well. And the million-dollar question might be, you know, if Prince Henry hadn't died and he'd succeeded James, or if Charles I had been a different sort of person, would we see James differently? But, you know, those are part of, you know, the endless counter factual history speculation.
Yeah, you can go down a particular rabbit hole, and we won't get done until Thursday. Where do you get the sources from for this one then? Because to put, as I said before, to put colour into this admittedly colourful, surprisingly colourful monarch.
I realised, I mean, although this was written obviously for the anniversary, I realised I've been thinking about James for years and years and years. My first lecture course, I think, when I was in my late 20s was on James. So I've been reading James. So a lot of it is James's own words. And I think that's what I really wanted to bring to the forefront. I mean, no monarch left more written record than James. It's not only the printed works. He claims that he wrote just about himself, every proclamation. There's huge correspondence. So James is a real wordsmith. So that's, you know, that's there. And in a way, it's been not exactly hidden in plain sight because we know, but it's not in easily accessible sort of editions often. But also some of it came out of my previous book, Devilland, England Under Siege, that was published in 2021, where there was just a huge lot of material that I couldn't use, but a lot of that was diplomats' reports. So I was really interested in what foreigners thought of England between 1588 and 1688. And they are fascinated by James, and they have years and years and years, you know, from the 1560s to the 1620s to observe him. So a lot of it was, you know, from that material that I'd gathered before. But then there were areas that I just would never have looked at in Devilland. There's a whole chapter on James and animals and hunting. You know, there's a chapter on James and his sort of physical constitution and portraits and dress and stuff. So, one of the challenging but really endlessly fascinating things about James is that he has an opinion and is interested in everything. So therefore, you suddenly find you have to keep doing these deep dives into sort of all sorts of areas. Things like he became really interested in the New World and Virginia and Jamestown and James River. And, you know, that's one sort of area over there. Then he's also really interested in the law and thinks that, you know, he is King Solomon, has a right to dispense judgment. He's very interested, obviously, in the King James Bible and, you know, biblical translation. So there's just lots and lots of witchcraft. And he writes, he's the only early modern king or monarch to write about witchcraft and demonology. So, one just has to kind of keep doing deep dives. And that's partly why I structured the book in a thematic way, because I just didn't want this great barrier of 1603 to sort of act as a sort of insuperable barrier. The fact that James presides over witchcraft trials as King of Scotland and then prosecutes people for vexatious claims of witchcraft as King of England in Star Chamber seems to me worth sort of comparing and studying together.
I mean, it seems that this is the you had to sort of rein it back a bit, because otherwise you know the deep dive could have had one of those Victorian tomes of 17 volumes. What are you hoping that people are going to learn? I mean, they're going to learn there's an awful lot more than, you know, the gunpowder plot, and perhaps they'll actually realise the gunpowder plot isn't just about letting off nice fireworks. It is an incredibly politically sensitive thing that leads to widespread persecution and slaughter.
I really hope hope it encourages people to just go and find out more about James in the area that particularly appeals to them. I mean, one of the really interesting things about this anniversary, just in conferences I've been to and discussions, is there is a real sense that there's still so much that we don't really know, that we haven't really, we've been asking perhaps older questions, but actually we, you know, James had a huge interest in, you know, sort of Eastern Europe and trying to sort of engage in diplomatic initiatives there. And, you know, a lot of those archives, I don't have the linguistic skills for, but there are scholars out there, you know, who do. And there's much more interest now in physicality of books, and James is sort of reconstructing his library and his engagement with printers. I mean, there's just so many areas that 50 years ago, historians weren't sort of thinking naturally of history, or food history. James is really interested in, you know, sort of food and diets and sort of banquets and things. So I just hope people will find little things that just kind of pique their interest and think, oh, I want to go and find out more about that. And there are certainly lots of references in the bibliography that they can follow up.
And presumably, of course, because it's been written from that Victorian standpoint, a lot of it, it's not looking to the East at all. You just mentioned things like that. So not even starting with Hungary, Ottoman Empire, etc., etc. And again, New World, a whole new kettle of pescado, as we say over here in Spain.
Yeah, and James is at one point asked if, you know, he's interested in establishing a sort of protectorate over Muscovy and Russia, and for various reasons that doesn't sort of happen. But, you know, that's the stature he has globally, and there is a sort of global dimension to all of this. So, you know, that's what I hope people go and, you know, he's in correspondence with the Shogun in Japan.
Good grief. There you go. Mind officially blown. You learn something new every day, and I have. The book is called The Mirror of Great Britain. Listeners, you can go onto our virtual bookstore, click on the front cover of the book, and it will wing its way to you. Claire, if people want to find you online, I'm not saying you TikTok in the sort of, you know, James the First TikTok, but can they find you on the socials? Do you have a website? Where can they post to find
you? I don't do socials, but I have a website, both the university, Cambridge University one, and my own personal one. So thank you very much for inviting me to talk about it.
I've absolutely loved it. As you can probably tell, the listeners are probably shaking their heads going, he's gone down another rabbit hole. The book is called The Mirror of Great Britain. I'm going to go out and get it. It's The Life of James the Sixth and the First. It's by Claire Jackson. Claire, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thank you very much.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.